Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'm Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and it's a pleasure to be hosting Tuesday Topics this evening. I'd like to thank Marlena for doing recording and Mr. Bowers and others in ACB Radio who edit our program and turn a chaos of conversation into an effective program. And of course, I'd like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities for making our program possible by enabling us to utilize the software that makes this chat room happen. So, welcome to everyone. I'd like to, in particular, welcome our guest this evening and our topic as well. It's a topic that's been endlessly fascinating to me, and I suspect is to many other blind people. Our guest wears many hats. She has worked for the last many years as the consumer relations person with the National Library Service in Washington, D.C., has been an active promoter of Ski for Light, and tonight she is with us to wear neither of those two hats, but in fact to wear a third. She is also, and that's why she's here tonight, an avid collector of slates and styluses, or styli. We'll ask her in a moment which is the correct plural. It is a great pleasure for me to welcome as my guest this evening one of the most avid collectors of slates and styluses, as well as one of the acknowledged experts on slates and styluses and how they work now and have worked in the past and might work in the future. So it's great to have you on the program, Miss Judy Dixon. Welcome. And it's also a pleasure to get to talk about one of my passions, and I know one of yours, the slate and stylus.
Thank you, Paul. And yes, certainly, slates and styluses. I haven't decided if it's styluses or styli or styli, but I think I usually just say styluses. But it's one of my favorite topics and one that I can talk about for quite a while.
That's a good thing. So why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about your collection? How many slates and styluses do you have? How many countries do they represent? And tell us just a little bit in general about the collection. And let's use that as our starting point.
Presently, the collection has 261 unique slates. I debate with myself frequently what really is a unique slate. Is a 27-cell, 4-line aluminum slate from HowlPress with the pins in the top different from a 27-cell, 4-line aluminum slate from HowlPress with pins in the bottom? I've decided that it is. Now, is one with pins in the bottom that has dymo holes different from ones with pins in the bottom that doesn't have dymo holes? Well, that gets a little bit less clear-cut, and it gets even less clear-cut when, what if they just have slightly different finishes and you can tell that they were made in different eras. So probably it's a little inconsistent, but occasionally I'll wait for the clock to stop timing. Occasionally I'll go through the whole collection and try to sort that out. There's really about 400 slates altogether, but I do have a fair number of duplicates, but 261 unique slates. They are from about 36 countries, I believe. Haven't counted lately, but I think that's right. And again, you can even get a little crazy about what's a country. Do I continue to count the slate that I got in East Germany separate from the slates that I got in Germany? So I suppose that other collectors, people who collect stamps and coins and things like that, must go through these same things, and I have no idea what kinds of decisions they make, but I'm kind of a slate collector of one, so I can make them for myself, I suppose. But the oldest slates are some slates that were handmade in Spain in the 1860s. And they're quite interesting. Quite a number of the slates, instead of having the six dots, the pits on the back like we're used to, actually have what are generally called furrows, which are lines, just straight lines, ridges, indented lines for putting the stylus into. And these older 1860s slates have those. A little hard to describe, but lots of the slates don't have, even modern slates from some of the European countries don't have the little notches on the sides of cells that American slates have, and they are much harder to write with than the ones that do have those. So the slates are enormously different. It's really quite mind-boggling. But I'm probably getting ahead of what you asked for here, the extent of the collection. I got a new one as recently as 2 weeks ago, so I still continue to acquire slaves. I do have a website. It is www.brailleslave.org. It's a little bit out of date. I think it says there are 250-something. I haven't updated it for a couple of months, but I will do that. There's also quite a lot of photographs on there. I've had some requests from people that I should finish the photography of the collection, but that's a little tricky to do, so I haven't done it.
The website is actually a fascinating place, and I would urge everyone to pay it a visit. A number of the questions that I'm actually going to be asking Judy tonight are going to be based on some of the issues that she, in fact, raises on her website herself. But before I get to that, let me ask you a little bit, if you know, about what impelled you to start collecting slates and styluses, and what is the kind of satisfaction that you derive from collecting such an animal?
I was kind of afraid you might ask me that, and I've really been thinking about what compelled me to start collecting slates. I actually wrote an article, I think it was in 1982 or 3, I think 83, that was published in the Matilda Ziegler magazine called The Bumpy Road to Literacy. And that's one of my better titles. I wish I hadn't wasted it on an article way back then. But it's an article, and in that article I talk about that I had 92 braille slates. So I was well along the way by 1983. I started... I probably had. I mean, when do you decide, you know, your drawer full of slates is a collection? I certainly started by the mid-70s, but I don't know when. It was probably not till the early 80s when I said, I'm going to collect slates now. And what intrigues me, one of the things that, I mean, apart from the stuff that's really important to all of us having to do with Braille and being able to write Braille by hand and those kinds of things, one of the things that intrigues me about collecting slates is that any one of them has virtually no intrinsic value. I mean, I don't want to collect anything that's valuable. And altogether, they do have value, and they have a lot of value to me. But I think any one of them is almost, you know, somebody else's junk. And I like collecting something that has no intrinsic value. And something, I think partly what I remember that when I got it's called a Tyler Margin Guide. It's a 4-cell slate, 4-cell one line that has no hinge, no pin. It looks like a paperclip. And I actually had two of them made into a pair of earrings some years ago, but because they're such tiny little slates. But I have one in the collection as well. And it was so intriguing. And I was like, I never knew about this. And so often when I get a new slate and it's so different and so unique from other slates that I have, and I think, I never knew about this. And it was so fun to learn about. And I just saw, just this summer, I saw a prototype of an upward writing slate being developed by RNIB. And it's a great prototype, and I can look at that prototype, and I know so much about what's been wrong with previous upward writing slates. I'm probably getting into one of your topics, and I apologize, but it's really fun to know a lot about a very tiny little corner of the world.
It actually is fascinating, and since we've actually started talking about it, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the characteristics of slate. And perhaps the best way to do it is to talk a little bit about the organization of your website. You have a description of each of your slates as one of your major sections, but the section that fascinated me, and I suspect may fascinate a lot of us who are really interested in the mechanics of Braille anyway, is the section that looks at characteristics that slates have that are different from those that are kind of common or garden slates in the United States, and what makes slates from other countries not only different, but I suspect in your opinion sometimes as well better, or certainly having features that are different and that perhaps we ought to consider. And one of the fascinating things to me is that you appear to divide the way that slates function into several categories. And maybe you could start by talking about some of those categories and then talk a little bit about some of the differences between slates that we're used to in this country, the kind of common or garden four-line slate, and those that are produced in other countries with some different characteristics.
I really do talk about slates in the sense of how they're physically structured, and looking at each structural element and how has that structural element been accomplished in other ways, which of those other ways are better or worse or good or bad. And then, unfortunately, what I'm often asked is, well, if you could design the perfect slate, you know, what would it be? And I don't know. I mean, this whole thing of looking at slates and all these different structural elements doesn't really come up with an answer. It comes up with a lot of questions and certainly a lot of ideas and a lot of thoughts about how should it be, how could it be. And there are some clever ideas. But most of the slates in my collection were manufactured not under ideal conditions, and they're not manufactured all that well. And so there's no perfect slate. I mean, I certainly don't have a perfect slate by any means. And let's take pins, for example. I look at pins as one of the elements. And we're familiar with slates with pins in the bottom. We're familiar with slates with pins in the top. And we're familiar, maybe some of us are familiar with slates with no pins. But there's other ways of accomplishing holding the paper into the slate. I personally don't like pins because I think pins have the effect of tearing paper and making it untidy. And so if some slates hold the paper with magnets. And magnets are great. They do a wonderful job of holding it. The disadvantage of that is you typically have to have the exact size piece of paper to go with the slate. There's a slate that fits into a little notebook from France called a Surdumat, which has a frame that the paper fits in, and then you just close the slate over it, and it holds it exactly right. There's one that we all know of. Remember the Jiffy slate. The Jiffy slate was really nice. It was very slick, very fast, good way to get paper and didn't make holes in things. So there are lots of other ways of managing holding paper into a slate without ripping holes in. And some of those have some disadvantages, but they do. Then I also, at one point in that, look at hinges, holding the two parts of the slate together. And one of the kind of unique slate structural patterns that's not common in the U.S., but fairly common in other countries, is a slate where the back of the slate is almost a full-size page or a full-size page, and the front of the slate is just two lines. So it's kind of like a board slate in that you move something down the page, but the paper is held in by just a frame that goes around the edge of the paper, and then this two-line guide is just moved down. And those are pretty common outside the U.S. But in terms of hinges, I have one slate in my collection that is two pieces of plastic held together by what looks like a piece of masking tape, heavier masking tape, probably some kind of heavy tape. But it's just a piece of tape. Now, that slate doesn't get used very often, so who knows how long it would last if it did. But there's one slate from Japan that's a card slate, and it has a swivel bar on the front of it, so you can have it do different sized cards, either vertically oriented or horizontally oriented. And that's quite nice. And then also in there, I look at special slate features, slates that are designed for special purposes. Many of them we're familiar with, the cassette label slate, the playing card slate, those kinds of things, and the various single line slates. The upward writing slates, which is a whole other topic, and then the slates that are designed, there are paper slates that don't use any paper, and there's some really very curious ones of those, if you can really call them slates. But there's one where the dots of the cell are like the tops of a ballpoint pen. So you press a dot down, it goes away. You press it again, and it comes back. The one I have several of them, but one of them is seven lines of 14 cells, and they're from Italy. They're still made. They're modern. And the downside of that is that you have to erase every single dot individually, which is definitely a difficult thing. Then I also have quite a lot of historic slates, and getting off the exhibit for just a moment, but back on the scope of the collection, there are a lot of historic slates, New York Point slates, and even some slates that did New York Point Braille combination, which are quite fun. And then a few slates that are proprietary, that some crazy man in Louisville named, his last name was Kafafian, developed a slate that has 16 dots arranged in four four dots squared, and then there's a bar that goes across. And he developed some code, and he thought it was better, and it's quite fun. It's a proper slate. It's made of metal and everything. But Emerson Folt gave me that slate years ago. It's quite an amazing collection.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that fascinated me about your examination of the various parameters of the slate was precisely what you suggested when you began to answer my question, which is that there didn't seem to be a final answer that you came up with, and in fact I was going to ask you about your perfect slate, so you have foiled me in my attempt to get you to design one. But I am going to take you back to something that you mentioned at the beginning about furrows and furrows impacting the speed at which you can write with the slate. And I'm going to ask you if perhaps you would at least comment on what for you in a slate makes writing Braille easier and faster. What are the things that for you make a difference in terms of making a slate more usable, and what do you look for? I notice that some of the comments you make on your website, for instance, also refer to the amount of noise a slate makes. So without talking about a perfect slate, maybe you could at least talk some more about some of the characteristics that for you make for a really good slate.
I think that it kind of depends on what you want to do with a slate. Slate noise is really caused as much by the paper as by the material of the slate. For many years, RNIB sold little cut sheets of Braillon, the kind of stuff that was used on thermoform machines in the U.S., but they sold it for people to write on with their slate frames in the U.K., and it was very quiet. So slate noise is a big issue for some people, and so that's why it's mentioned a lot in the website, not one of my personal issues so much. But one of the slates that I have, it's really interesting. It's from Portugal, and the front of it is a very heavy, very highly polished metal of some kind, but extremely highly polished. And the back of it is just aluminum and very lightweight aluminum. So the whole overall slate is not too heavy, yet the front is really this quite nice heavy metal. But because this metal is heavy and because it's so highly polished, it is one of the fastest slates to braille on because the metal is so smooth and nice. I think that the texture of the material that it's made out of is very, very critical to how nice it is to braille on. And certainly the stylus is a huge factor. Stylus is almost... I've had this idea for years that what we ought to do for styluses is to get some material like something that, you know, dentists make molds out of or somebody makes a mold out of, and you can just hold it in your hand, mold up a little piece of plastic, get it just right, and then let it harden, and then that would, you know, stick a stylus point in it, and that would become your stylus. I think we'd all have slightly different shapes. I personally don't like the flat styluses that are so popular these days. They hurt my hand. I like round styluses. I have one from Brazil that's called an anatomical stylus, and it's very, very hard to scribe, but it's actually quite comfortable. And styluses are hard to... I have one with a bail that goes over the top, and you actually put your finger through the bail. The bail holds your finger in place. My finger doesn't slip off the stylus very much, so it's not been... And then lots of reversible ones, and, you know, ones where the points go inside, or ones that don't roll. And the Japanese like to tether their styluses to their slates. So their slates always have a little hole somewhere in them, and the stylus has a little hole, so that the two always stay together.
In terms of styluses, you actually have some right-handed and left-handed styluses too, which I was fascinated by. But it makes perfect sense to imagine that if you are right-handed or left-handed, it would make a difference. I find it very difficult to imagine a left-handed stylus user, but I understand that there are quite a few of them. If you had to pick your single most unusual slate, what do you suppose that would be?
It's a very difficult question. Some of the paperless slates are truly unique, but I'm just trying to think about what would be... I think I have some Italian slates that were made by an individual, and I don't think that there were a lot of them ever made, and there are three in this that I have, three different sizes, and they're really quite fun. One of them especially has, it's a full page, has magnets at the top and bottom. The back is plastic, the front is metal. The back has the furrows, like I was talking about before. The back, actually, the paper can be held in by both magnets, and the back can sort of swing away. allowing you to read it, read the writing after while it's being written. It's quite curious. It has a lot of other features. It has a sort of line guide, slides down it up front. I think I like the ones that are almost whimsical, that they have lots of quirky features and so forth. I have several that have multiple sizes of Dymo tape slot, which are kind of fun. And some of the full page ones have holes for loose leaf notebooks and, for a time, a couple of those plastic German ones that were full page and had the holes for the loose leaf notebooks were sold here in the U.S. There's actually quite a lot of foreign-made slates sold in the U.S. now. This is a relatively recent, I'd say in the last 10 years, relatively recent phenomenon. Independent Living Aids has the Optima slate, which is the small version is a metal interline slate. Interline is, some of you may not be familiar with that. It's quite common in the U.K. and some other countries, but it's, the lines are closer. Well, the Janus slate is an interline slate, and probably most of you know that. But this is a metal interline slate. I think it's 8 lines by 19 or 20 cells, and 8 lines on each side. And then they also have a full-page Optima slate, and those two are from South Africa. And they have some other slates, I think the German slates as well, and Maxi Aids has a few also. So there are some novel, and then Independent Living Aids has a whole line of slates from India. So they have quite a nice assortment of slates available.
One question that I guess has intrigued me: when I was growing up, board slates were kind of the norm. At least they were what we were taught to use in school, but since I've been an adult, I haven't seen nearly as many kind of board slates in use in this country. But it would seem from looking at your collection that modern board slates or full-page slates seem to be far more popular in Europe than they are in this country. Would you concur with that? Do you have any speculations as to why that might be?
Well, I think the reason we don't see so many board slates anymore is because they've gotten astronomically expensive. Even some of the pocket slates have gotten really expensive, but the board slates are now in the $40 and $50 range. When efforts were made to make slates less expensive, getting rid of the board was certainly one way to do it. There is a board slate in that collection of slates from India that are new and much less expensive. I know APH had a plastic version of their board slate for a while, and it was pretty horrible. There is still a lot of board slates in the UK, but again, I don't know that they've actually physically made one in quite some time. I mean, my collection is full of many slates that were made quite a long time ago. And even in the U.S., I mean, how many are they actually really making now? Not too much, but mostly people are buying them from other countries just to get the price down.
Do you think that board slates are more popular in Europe and are being used more in Europe now than we're using them here?
I think the full-page slates are more popular. And, I mean, let's face it, probably Braille is used more. Certainly, it would still seem to be the case in the U.K., and I would expect that it is in other countries in Europe as well. But I think that, they probably don't have a Perkins Brailler on every street corner because they're more expensive because of exchange rates and so forth. So I think slates are still pretty popular in the UK as well. Whether board slates, as we know them, are used more, probably they are. But I don't have any data. I don't know.
By the way, I commend you for putting another document that I'll call people's attention to, and we're about to open it up for people to raise issues with you, because I'm sure people have other burning questions they'd like to raise. But I'd like to commend your website for also having the fact sheet from Able Data on your website. I think that's actually a very useful document to have there, and maybe you could talk to folks a little bit about what that fact sheet does and what it's for, and perhaps any final thoughts that you might have about your website or about your collection before we open it up for questions.
Yes, that's really a nice fact sheet, and it's relatively current. I think it was written in 2004. It's a fact sheet on manual Braille writing and labeling, and it's really lovely. It extols the virtue of slates and reviews what kind of slates. It talks about slates for labeling, and it talks about labeling in general, and that Braille is so useful for labeling. I was surprised to see such a positive piece written about slates so relatively recently.
Let's open things up for questions or comments for Judy. There are certainly lots of other areas of the slate and stylus that we could get into. Remember, as you go through, try to be concise with your questions, and remember there are loads of other people who probably have questions for Judy as well. Please remember to tell us who you are and where you're from, and the floor is open.
Hi, Judy and Paul. This is Bonnie. And Judy, I want to say that I really applaud you for keeping this collection and for doing anything that you can to keep Braille alive. When I started school, I'm from Ohio, by the way, temporarily in St. Louis. But when I started school, I was taught to use a Braille writer because when I began school in the late 50s, early 60s, the belief was that people would have a hard time with dexterity at a young age, say 6 or 7, learning with slates and styluses. And I made myself learn, and I envy you your collection, and that's really all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It really is a fun collection. And what you said about when you learned Braille in school got me to thinking about a point I wanted to make. I really think that part of my enchantment with the Braille slate. I went to a school for the blind in first grade and part of second grade. And when I was in first grade, they started teaching us how to use the Braille writer, and we used the Braille writers and dragged those heavy things all over the room. And it probably didn't happen exactly this way, but this is my recollection, is that just a day or two before the Christmas holidays of first grade, our teacher gave each of us a Braille slate. And mine was blue, I remember that. And it taught each of us how to use it, and then sent us home for Christmas vacation with it. And it was so fun to go home for Christmas vacation and show my brothers and my parents, you know, look, I can write. I can do something. I learned something in school. I can write my name. I can write. You know, you guys can't read it. Well, we won't worry about that. But I can write. And I remember playing with that slate over Christmas vacation when I was in first grade. I was able to take something home, and it was tangible, and I could show them that I could do something. And it was just a perfect time for me to be introduced. And I don't remember any great, you know, long lessons and grand. Just, here it is. Here's how you use it. And that was that. And it's my slate's been near me ever since.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. Could you elaborate a little more on what interline Braille is? I think that you started talking about it, but I was wondering, what's the difference between interline Braille and just regular Braille?
Okay, there's slates that have regular Braille. You write on one side of the page, and that's that. And the spacing between the line is similar to what we'd see in any Braille book or what we might get from a Perkins Brailler. Interline has lines on both sides of the page, and the slate have, you put the paper in and you write on the line. The lines are spaced probably 3/4 of a line apart or so. And then on the other side of the slate, there's also lines you can write on. And so when you take the paper out, you've got Braille on both sides. It's not quite double spaced on each side, but it's pretty close to it. It's you know, sort of 3/4 spaced on each side or a space and a half. But now there's also interpoint, and there's various ways of making interpoint slates. And interpoint slates make Braille like what we'd find in most press Braille books. And with those, generally you write on one side of the paper, and then you do something. You turn it over and position the paper on pins in a different way or punch some new holes. There's different ways to do it. But you do something, and then you write on the second side, and whatever you did offsets the paper just the right amount so it knows to stay out of the way of the dots that you already made. And the slates are usually made with little dimples on the backs of the inside of the front of the slate so that it doesn't crush the dots you've already made. Hope that answered.
Judy, the trick with that in the inner line slate is that if you have to have the piece of paper or card that's in it absolutely tight and secure. Otherwise, you get some really horrible frill. And I found that using a rubber band across the ends of it where the card is the best way to keep it stable. Of course, then you have to keep moving the rubber band, but at least you can read the braille, which is produced that way. Do you like the stylus that has one flat side so it doesn't roll away? I love that one, but I wouldn't want it flat on both sides.
I do like those styluses with one flat side. That's a clever idea. And there's some that are made with lots of little flat sides, which are kind of nice. They're kind of round, but they just have a little flat edges so they don't roll very far. Judy, this is Marlena in Seattle. I want to go back to the promoting the use of slates in our school systems and among Braille users. You already know that I, like you, you know, use a slate and don't travel, don't leave home without one, that and the credit card. But one of the things that frustrates the heck out of me is that teachers tell people, whether they're kids in school or they're older adults learning the slate, well, you have to write Braille backwards. And I don't see it as writing Braille backwards, and I think that confuses people more when you tell them that. And I wonder what your thoughts are about that.
Yes, I agree. I think anybody who's going to teach a slate or explain the slate should never use the B word. You know, just think of it as writing forward. You're just writing one side of the cell, then the other. One side of the cell, and then the other. And you write the first side first and the second side second, so what's the problem? But no, I think if you, you know, if you look at any books about teaching the slate, they typically speak about, you know, don't start by saying you're going to write it backwards.
I'm really enjoying your presentation, Judy. I'm a slate user, and I love the slate, and I get very irritated when, people say to sighted people, throw away your pencils because you don't need them. If you have a slate stylus and paper, that's all you ever need in life, because all fancy implements can break. Your slate stylus, well, it can, your stylus can roll across the room and never be found, and your slate can get bent and all kinds of things. But I am a dedicated slate stylus user. I started on the slate stylus because I went to school around the end of World War II, and Braille writers, not very, you couldn't really get them. We had two in our class, or I was in a Braille class, and went to regular class in a school, but I don't want on and on my training, but I'm looking forward to go to your website, and thank you, you're wonderful.
Hi, Judy. It's Debbie Hazelton here in South Florida. I very much enjoyed your presentation. I'm fortunate in that I was exposed to the slate actually even before the Braille writer. My mother had one because she was trying to learn Braille. I didn't care for the slate too much, but I sure did work with it, and I'm glad I did. And now, I mean, I always have a slate with me. I love my slate. One of the experiences I had was with one of those pen styluses that came in a little notebook I think AFB put out a while back. I didn't like that pen. I thought it looked cool, but, ooh, that one really hurt my hand. I'm wondering if you know of this Brannan slate you probably know of. I've been hearing that this has been used for people doing math, but also people into the Sudoku puzzles. Do you think it's a slate? It sounds very different. It's all these little cubes, I guess, with Braille on them and all these little squares. I think I remember working with one years ago when I was in school.
Hi, Debbie. Yeah, thank you. I do know about the Brannan slate. It's what we called, when I was in school, the Cubarhythm slate. And APH now sells one with a rubber board and the cube. And it's not really a slate. I think it's number 246 in my collection. For some reason, I decided to incorporate it into the collection. And I don't really know why, because it isn't, but, you know, probably everything counts. It's not really a slate. But we used, when I was in school, we did our math puzzles on it, math problems on it, and it worked very well. I loved it for that. Which actually reminds me of a point I wanted to make when we were discussing my little exhibit on the website about slates in general and their manufacture. And one of them is material. And I believe that a major deterrent to slate use is the materials that are used these days. We have plastic ones that become brittle and pieces break off of them after a fairly short time. And we have aluminum ones which bend and never bend back. Or we have those nickel-plated brass ones which are heavy and also bend and never bend back. And I'm certainly no plastics or materials expert, but I can't help but believe that with modern materials these days, there ought to be something that they can make a slate out of that would be durable, flexible, make decent dots, be nice and quiet, and not bend and not break. I have some interesting examples of how materials have been used in slate in the collection, but again, there's no ideal. I do have a couple with some rubber part, but over the years, the rubber dries out, and I think that there are some modern materials people need to look at the kind of material that slates are made of.
I'm intrigued by this question, was when I looked at your website as well, because I think What came to my mind was were a few thoughts. One was that slates are so often made by people who don't use them themselves. They're made by organizations for the blind rather than organizations of the blind. And I think the other thing is that they are typically regarded as relatively inexpensive and often not as really devices that need to be carefully machined. It would also be interesting to actually see some more consumer research done. One of the things that I've been thinking about all through this program tonight, Judy, and maybe you'd care to comment on it, is have you ever seen any countries that have done very much work kind of relating to the consumer reports of slates, where a set of characteristics have actually been defined by users rather than by manufacturers? It might be a fun thing to undertake, maybe even as a questionnaire in a Braille Revival League newsletter, for instance.
No, I don't know of any instance of any kind of research on slates. I mean, I think they have been regarded as so ephemeral, and yet, you know, how press and APH will point to how few they sell, which is why they don't put a lot of energy into them. But, you know, it's one of those kind of catch-22 things where you don't sell that many because, you know, what you've got haven't been modernized in a long time. The major efforts that I'm aware of in slate development have been in the area of the upward writing slate. And there have been a number of them developed over the years. In the early 90s, there was a upward writing slate that made lots of claims and got lots of press, and even in the general press, it was called the Hawk upward writing slate, made by a man named Larry Hawk, who was an engineer at what was that place in Tennessee that glows, the Knoxville, Fort Knox. Fort Knox, yeah. Anyway, Fort Knox. He worked for the Department of Energy. And he really raised a lot of money and had tools made. And his, I mean, this man was so sincere and so dedicated to the idea of making a better mousetrap. And yet the device that he came up with is truly no better than any other upward writing slate. And it remains to be seen. I'm not even, I think about this a lot and I don't know the answer, but it remains to be seen. Is the major deterrent to slate use the fact that we do write the first half and the second half, but we do it from right to left? Is that the major deterrent to slate use? I'm really thinking that it is. I think there's a lot of other things that are required to use a slate, not the least of which is that it's not tremendously fast. You can't read it instantly in most slate designs, and you have to be reasonably precise to get the right dots. That's probably the biggest issue, and it doesn't matter which direction you're writing, you still have to be reasonably precise. As I mentioned earlier, I did see a prototype of a new upward writing slate being developed by the RNIB, and I think it has a much better chance of being successful. The problem with the upward writing slates that have been developed so far is what they've done is taken, imagine, okay, I actually have one in my collection. I have six or seven of them, but I have one that looks exactly like what I'm about to describe. Take your average four-line metal pocket slate. Okay, take the two parts apart and turn the back over so that the bumps face up instead of the pit. Now, put the slate back together. And then you have a hollow-pointed stylus, and all you do is put that hollow-pointed stylus straight down on one of those bumps, and it supposedly makes a dot. Well, the problem is that a blind person doesn't use a slate that way. A blind person takes the stylus and kind of looks around in the cell to find that exact spot where to press down to make your dot. And the effect of looking around in the cell means that the dot that gets made is not a very precise and discernible dot. Little shadow dots get made in other parts of the cell because of the looking around. The one that RNIB is designing has sort of two levels. You have the cell opening, but then there's another kind of floor to the cell, an eighth of an inch down or so, and then there's smaller holes that the stylus goes into. And so you put the stylus in the cell, and then you can look around all you want, but when you come to that moment when you press down, you're really pressing down in a very small hole. It makes great looking braille, and I'm really, really hoping that they end up being successful about this, because when I was speaking to them about it, they said, yes, this is a slate that's been designed by blind people. It as I said earlier, it does, I think, remain to be seen is, you know, what is the major deterrent slate use? Is it the fact that we can't write in an upward or left to right manner? But if it is, and if it has the effect of causing more people to use a slate, then I'm all for it.
This is Don Moore from Port Charlotte, Florida. I remember seeing an upward writing slate back in the late 50s, early 60s. It was marketed with the raised line drawing kit. That was when we used it in the Braille class I was attending. It was very difficult to write with that. I remember that, because you had to try to make sure that the stylus was in the exact right spot and so forth, and it was just slow. It did make nice braille, but it was slow.
Was that a single line slate, Don?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, I have one of those. It actually came with a map making kit, I think. I keep reading that slate came from ASB, and I find that kind of interesting, because I don't know of ASB ever making slates. The American Braille Press in Paris made some slates, but that single line upward writing slate is an interesting one. It looks like a giant pair of tweezers.
This is Brian from Watertown, Massachusetts. I've had the fortune, great fortune, to be able to take a look at this collection in Judy's home. And one of the impressive things about the collection is how you have it stored. Can you take a moment and tell us about how you maintain your collection?
Well, that's actually kind of amusing, because for years the collection found its way into file folders fairly early on, and the file folders lived in some cardboard storage boxes for some time. And then I guess around 15 years ago, I got a bookcase, a very tall, narrow bookcase, and loaded all the file folders into the bookcase. Well, some of the slates were too big for that, but the majority of them fit, and that's where they live. And about, maybe a year and a half ago, I got the idea that I really wanted to find something better to put the slates in. And a friend of mine did some research for me, and she found a website called homemuseum.com. And I actually spent probably 4 months emailing back and forth with this guy who runs homemuseum.com. And he has boxes and shelves and so forth for every kind of collection. Well, he doesn't have anything for slate collect, but he has boxes. But the long and the short of it is, in the end, he was willing to basically build me whatever I wanted, and then I had to decide what I wanted, which was not that easy. And what I ended up with are two cabinets. Each cabinet has 36 drawers in it. In each cabinet is the same. 31 of the drawers are 1 inch deep. Each drawer is 22 inches by 13 inches. And each drawer can come completely out. So when you pull the drawer out, it becomes almost like a tray. You can sit down in a chair and look at it and so forth. And so in each cabinet, there's 31 1-inch drawers, 4 2-inch drawers, and 1 3-inch drawer. And the 3-inch drawer in both cabinets is at the very bottom. The other 2-inch drawers can move around anywhere. I'm having brass drawer number labels. Have I gone around the bend yet? I'm having these drawer labels. Kim Christensen Design, who makes the Braille jewelry, is making these labels for me. And they're labeled A1, A2, A3, and then A36, B1, B2. And so that filthy labels. And then the drawers are lined with felt, and they have Braille labels under each slate. And so it's actually, and anybody and everyone's invited to come and look at the slates. I now have a slate catalog and Braille and print catalog of all of them and indexed by, each slate has a record number in the database, it has a drawer number, and it has a what I call a shelf number, which is a whole cataloging system that I have gone around the bend now.
Judy, I remember sitting in your condo with the two of us sitting on the floor with the file folders of slate all over the place and how fascinating it was to look at the slates. And then I remember when I saw your cabinet, I thought, boy, she's come a long way from the file folders. Why do people who make the slate not do what the Japanese do? Why on earth, what use would you have for your slate without your stylus? It's only the Japanese who do that, or are there other slates that actually tether, that have the stylus is tethered to?
I'm only aware of the Japanese who have designed it in putting holes in their styluses to do it. The downside is that, you know, it does get a little awkward sometimes to put it away. If you grab your slate and throw it in your handbag or throw it in your pocket, sometimes you find you have a stylus trailing out and things like that. So they can be a bit inconvenient, although you can certainly detach them without too much difficulty. So it's nice to have the holes so you can tether them if you want to.
I remember seeing a stylus at school, the school of mind, where you could take the point off and then turn it over and put it back in, and it could avoid stabbing yourself. I guess for some reason, if I remember why they made such a thing. I think the best slate I have that I like is the Dymo slate. Seems like the Braille is a lot clearer with that one. And, of course, I have the pocket slate that has the six lines. I think it's six lines. And then there's one that had... That's kind of a different kind of a slate. It's got a rolled up piece of braille or something. It's kind of in a roll. I haven't used it a lot, but I have one of those. I had a stylus that was a bit different from the average. It was homemade. I haven't really used it that much, but it's quite an interesting topic tonight about slates and stylus.
Hi, Judy. This is Sue Amateur from Washington State. Interesting show. I came in a little late. I hope you repeat your website. I'm fascinated about your cabinet. That's pretty neat. I have a question and then just a little anecdotal thing. Do you think that a lot of people stop using slates because of the Braille and Speaks and Braille lights and Braille notes? And I sure hope the teachers... Kids can use both, I would hope, because sometimes your Braille light or Braille note goes down. But one of the things that was kind of interesting when I did a lot of my investigative work at the Human Rights Commission, when you did conferences, people are very fascinated. Sighted people really think slates are fascinating. And so if you were using your slate and stylus, they'd be so intent on watching you. I used to be able to ask them questions like, well, did you say you didn't hire that person because they were a woman? And they'd go, oh, yes, but tell me about your slate. So my coworkers all wanted to learn the slate and stylus so that they could get better answers out of the clients.
Let's see, I have a number of things. Yes, I do think part of the decline of the slate is the popularity of note takers and so forth, but I think it started before that. You know, everybody thinks that it's coupled with the idea that it's difficult. But you're right, the note taker runs out of batteries or dies or whatever, and sometimes your slate's the fastest thing to grab. Your comment about sighted people liking slates reminds me, last summer I was contacted by the curator of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Museum in Mankato, Minnesota, near Walnut Grove. Those of you who were Little House in the Prairie fans may remember Laura Ingalls and her sister Mary, who became blind. She actually became blind on the TV show as well. She was a pretty good blind person. And this curator of this museum was wanting to know what kind of, wanted to have a Braille slate and was making an interactive exhibit for the kids because it's a very interactive kind of kid-oriented museum. And I and the APH museum curator did some research, and we found out that Mary Ingalls actually went to the Iowa School for the Blind. She enrolled there in 1881, and her first thing she learned was New York Point. So we arranged to get her a New York Point slate and send her some photos and so forth. So the kids who visit the Laura Ingalls Wilder Museum will learn what Mary learned and how she learned it. But she she was a teacher and eventually married a blind man who was also a teacher, so I'm sure she learned Braille later on. So they have Braille there as well.
This is Bonnie again. That I think that that was one of the most wonderful things about a Slayton stylist. You could very easily bridge the gap a bit and teach sighted people Braille in a very cheap way. And I also had a rather strange thought, but maybe apt for today, and that is that possibly another reason that if public schools ever had any reason to discourage the use of slates and styluses, everything is a weapon today. And I wonder if in public schools, especially today, being that there is not a lot of understanding in terms of mainstreaming and people with multiple disabilities these days, I wonder if we would also run into a problem of styluses being considered a weapon.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I was looking at a list of prohibited items in terms of taking things on board aircraft. And one of the first things they exempted from consideration for confiscation from a passenger boarding a plane was a Slayton stylus, named specifically.
Judith Sherrill from, and I used Slayton when I was in college for a short period of time. I learned third grade Braille and used just regular notebook paper and was able to easily, within an hour, four and a half pages of Braille with that, with a note. But the thing that was really difficult was, well, two things. One was sound. All of the kids' class were pretty distracted, I think, at some point. They finally got, but the sounds are one. But the other thing is style, your hand. But anyway, I can't get this thought out of my head. So here we go. Tell me what you think of it. You're talking about a style that you wish you could grab some sort of good stuff in your hand form and make some of that support of your own. And so I'm thinking about plaque parrot. And I'm wondering, have you ever experimented with that work? And then coat it with, covering with the stuff you can buy, you know, that sponge stuff, too thick. It comes in different varieties. You get it on handlebars on bike or on, and cutting form onto that piece of more. Or the kind of stuff that's on grip is ribs as well. So I don't know. Think of that.
I like the idea of the stuff that's on the grip of a pen. I think if a stylus had that kind of stuff coating it, it could really be a lot easier to use. It wouldn't slip and slide. I'm thinking that a plaster of Paris might be also kind of heavy and maybe end up being a little fragile. But there's got to be molding stuff that hardens and becomes. I would think there's something used in either the audiology industry or the for earplugs and or the dental industry or some industry.
Judy, when I had my hand surgery recently, I think that this might be a key for you to think about. The physical therapist, the hand therapist, took a sheet of flat. It was just like a sheet, and she heated it up and molded it around my thumb and made my own hand splint. And I'm just sitting here thinking, this is exactly the kind of thing that you're thinking about, because it's very lightweight and very durable. I mean, I could clobber somebody over the head with it. It wouldn't break. So I think you're on to something.
Brian here. I assume that as with other collections, your collection wasn't collected one piece at a time, that there were times when you got several pieces from a pre-existing hoard or collection or whatever you want to call it. Did anybody help you put this collection together? And how many slates did you get from a single location? I see a whole list of countries here. And did you have some cohorts out in the world who would send you these slates?
Yes, actually, there are a couple of examples of those things. Three, anyway. A good friend of mine, Pedro Zurita, for a time, for some years, was the Secretary General for the World Blind Union through the 80s and up to the mid-90s. And in his travels, he collected slates for me. And there's a really sizable portion of this collection that Pedro gathered for me on his travels. That's been a big part of it. There was a gentleman, he lived during his working years in San Antonio, Texas. His name was David Roniker, and he worked in a darkroom there. And when he retired in the early 90s, I guess, or mid-90s, he and I corresponded and traded slates for years and years, traded Braille writers. I used to collect Braille writers, but in the early 90s, I gave my entire Braille writer collection to APH for their museum. A Braille writer collection will move you out of your house. You can't just confine it to cabinet. So APH now has it. But they won't get the slates yet. Someday. But this David Roniker moved to upstate New York, and when he was getting older, I actually had the opportunity to go and visit him in upstate New York, and he did in fact die on September 10th, 2001. And when he died, APH made an offer to his heir for his collection, and they were generous enough to share part of that collection with me. So I got 17 slates, and he had about 175 slates in that collection. So APH has a nice chunk of slates now from that collection for their collection, although I still think theirs probably isn't quite as big as mine.
Hi, Judy. It's Sue again, and I was just thinking if we could find an ergonomist who would be really interested in the stylus issue, that could be fascinating. You know, if a lot of you look at the way pens are made now, ergonomic pens are vastly different than the way pens were made even 5 or 10 years ago.
I think it's a good question, Sue, and I think, in fact, there are a number of good questions that have been raised tonight, and I guess I will ask the last question of Judy and ask her to sort of look in her crystal ball. I think we've all noted the decline of the slate over the last 20 years, and whether we ascribe the cause to mainstreaming or to note takers or to or whatever we decide the cause is, does the Braille slate have a future? And if so, what is that future? Or is it likely to go the way of the dodo bird and become an extinct species? What do you think, Judy?
Well, I certainly think it has a future because I think blind people are going to want to write Braille by hand. But I also think that unless somebody somewhere put some thought and energy into manufacturing a slate of modern materials and in a very functional way, that slate isn't going to be all that useful for the blind people who do want to write by hand.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being a part of Tuesday Topics this evening. I think we've established that the lowly slate and stylus has a tremendous place in the lives of blind people, and that we who are involved in using slates and styluses are certainly very glad they're there and would be in a very different place in terms of literacy were they not there. I'd like to thank Judy Dixon for being our guest this evening and for providing us with all kinds of information about her collection. For those of you who perhaps didn't have the opportunity to write down her website, it is www.brailleslates, BrailleSlates.org. BrailleSlates.org. And for a fascinating afternoon or evening, I strongly recommend a visit to her website. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we're not yet sure what we're going to do. We're looking at a number of exciting topics, including Space Camp and blind participation in it, including National Industries for the Blind that we still want to do a program on, and including a fascinating question. Is it possible to change society's attitudes towards blindness? Tune in next week to Tuesday Topics. One of these three topics, or another, will be featured, and we hope you'll join us on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. The first time you enter the chat room, the software will automatically download and install on your computer. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.